Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and this week we will be talking to Dr. Grimm, Private Eye's human rights correspondent, about the plight of the Uyghur Muslims in China. We'll also be having a historical retrospective about the life and times of Marcia Williams, a.k.a. Lady Forkender, a.k.a. Lady Forkbender, who was an incredibly powerful figure in Harold Wilson's administration. She was very much the Alistair Campbell of her day, and as we will hear, she was one of the people who kept Private Eye's lawyers nice and busy for a good number of years. Later on, we'll be talking to Frances Ween and Adam McQueen about her. But first, the Uyghur Muslims are an ethnic group who live in Xinjiang in China. For some years, they have been harassed, imprisoned, and re-educated by the Chinese government, which is determined to stamp out the religious differences that make them who they are. Dr. Grimm is Private Eye's correspondent on matters of human rights and particularly human rights abuses. I asked her, first of all, who the Uyghur are and where they live.
Xinjiang is a province of Western China, quite a large province, bordering a lot of other countries. It's got 11 million Uyghur people in it who are Turkic Muslims and a fair sprinkling of Kazakh and Kyrgyz and other people too. It's about 36% Han Chinese. And there's been a policy since, well, certainly since 2014 and more intensively since 2016, of a sort of complete cultural repression and shutdown of the Uyghur people, which kind of is amounting to a sort of cultural obliteration. So silently, with the world, really, if they can see it, they're not responding to it, really. We're all silent and no one's communicating in and no one's communicating out. So these people are sort of silently disappearing.
What form does that cultural obliteration that you describe take?
It's the entire power of the state turned on a people. So it's intensive surveillance to an extraordinary level. So facial recognition software, CCTV everywhere, QR codes on houses, checkpoints everywhere they go, lack of freedom of travel, certainly lack of freedom of speech. But beyond that, there's no freedom to practice religion. There's no freedom to wear cultural dress or to freely speak the language or to express ideas or to communicate outside the region. So every expression of differentness from Han Chineseness is being crushed and obliterated.
What are the penalties, if you like, that are exacted for anyone who does break these rules about expression of religion or speech or whatever it may be?
Well, it depends how far you go. The surveillance seems to be aimed at detecting any sorts of signs that signify, you know, that you're an ideological problem. And then people are ranked in sort of levels of untrustworthiness. And depending on the ranking you get, you may just be watched at home, and that can be quite intensive. People can be put into your home with you, to live with you and watch you. It's called the homestay program. Or beyond that, you may be forcibly interned in a re-education camp. And we think there are over 1 million out of the 11 million are now in these camps being taught to admire the party, not to speak their own language anymore, to be obedient, to confess to their supposed crimes and so forth. Beyond that, there's detention and imprisonment.
The infractions that you describe in your articles in The Eye are extraordinary. They're things like owning a tent or watching a foreign-made film.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, anything that suggests that your loyalties might be other than totally focused on Xi Jinping and the party. So, I mean, one of the things that neighbours are meant to report their own neighbours for is suddenly giving up alcohol, for instance, as a sort of label of Muslimness, and people will come and watch you for that. Or applying for a passport, that will raise eyebrows, and passports have been confiscated by and large. So all sorts of really kind of small things. Women can't cover their hair in public. Not paying your phone bill will make somebody look into you. So anything that suggests you're not being a really true party member and citizen.
This might sound like a stupid question. What is in it for the Chinese government in doing this? This is a very small proportion of the Chinese population living in a slightly out-of-the-way bit of China. What is the purpose of this exercise?
I suspect philosophically you need to look at the kind of the political ethos of the Chinese state for that, which seems to depend on sameness and consistency and being of a group and not being individual. So the concept of human rights is not liked by the party apparatus. We've seen that they've you know, they've had a mass arrests, really, of human rights lawyers. It's not a, it doesn't sit well in a country where they're prioritizing group values. And so even though Xinjiang is distant, it's regarded as a difficult border area. And, you know, if you withdraw from it, you've got another border. They need the space, I suppose. And of course, if you can make these people Chinese, if you can make them into Han Chinese people in a couple of generations, then any sort of dissonance within your Chineseness, I suppose, will go away. You know, you don't have to have a Holocaust. You're not trying to eliminate genetics. You're just trying to eliminate culture. So if you force it out of people, it will be forgotten and it will be gone. So then you've got your Chinese population as you want them.
And this is another element, is moving in populations of other people. So the majority of Chinese people are the Han ethnicity, and those people are being moved in to alter the demographic of the whole province. Is that right?
Yeah, they have been for a long time, actually. And of course, some of that may be population pressure generally. But I think in 1949, Xinjiang was only 7% Han Chinese, and it's now about 36% Han Chinese. And we saw the same in Tibet. So it's a way of kind of diluting the kind of cultural differentness of Xinjiang. And in fact, there are financial rewards for Han individuals who marry Uyghur individuals. So there's a sort of wish to dilute the generations too.
You mentioned the story of human rights lawyers. And in fact, this is something you've written about, the story of Wang Quanzhang.
Yes. Well, he's been the last to be sentenced of a group of about 250 Chinese lawyers, human rights lawyers, who were arrested about 3 years ago in a crackdown. And they had done things like represent Falun Gong members and represent people on human rights issues. And they had been threatened before in various kind of slightly Orwellian ways, you know, phone calls and hints as to what would happen to their licenses and their families and their futures. But it became an actual series of arrests, and the treatment of these people when they were being detained, it was quite appalling. I mean, there are a lot of evidence that people were force-fed medication, that people were subject to various techniques that we would refer to as torture, that they had their trials repeatedly rehearsed until they would say the right thing, and it was then filmed and shown on Chinese TV, and they were then either sentenced or released. Most of them have been released now, but they've lost their licenses to practice. They can't be lawyers anymore. And some of them appear fairly broken by the experience.
This must present a lot of challenges for reporters and people trying to get the truth out about this, because obviously you're dealing with an extremely secretive government apparatus.
Yes. I mean, you certainly couldn't go in there as an accredited journalist and ask questions. You'd be fairly swiftly ejected at best. Most of the information we have about Xinjiang now is from people who have already left, who've been in camps and who've got out. So Human Rights Watch, for instance, did a big investigation last year, and they're quite careful to corroborate their stuff. So if an interviewee tells them something, they'll corroborate it before they publish it, if they can. So there's quite a lot of information sort of on the web, if you look, from people who've come out, from people who've interviewed them. There's also, actually, surprisingly, a fair amount of stuff in academic circles, in people who are studying Xinjiang for one reason or another, you know, sort of anthropologists and ethnologists and people like that. And that seems to have a little bit more freedom still. But essentially, as the crackdown has become tighter, it's become almost impossible to find anything out. And people who are Uyghur outside China can no longer speak easily to those inside China. There's a list of countries that are particularly banned by the Chinese, which are largely Muslim countries. But it's beginning to seem as if any contact, even with a country outside that group, will cause problems for the people inside. So, yes, you're quite right. It's quite difficult to get information now. The silence, I suppose, is evidence in itself, but it's quite difficult to know what's going on in the camps. There's satellite evidence that the camps have grown massively and that a lot of orphanages have been built too for the children, presumably, of people who've been interned. But no one really knows today exactly what's happening to a Uyghur person in the camps. What we know is what happened to them at the beginning of last year.
Is that when people were disappeared?
It began, a party secretary became the new leader of Xinjiang province. That was August 2016. The real crackdown sort of corresponds with his presence there. And the people who've been interviewed who were of particular interest to organisations trying to describe this are the ones who were there after August 2016 but have come out since.
Right. It sounds like it's a very difficult job to corroborate these stories or to pull together a lot of different accounts to get an overall picture.
Yes, it is difficult, yeah.
What's the reaction been like from other majority Muslim countries such as those in the Middle East?
Well, rather quiet, people say, and the assumption is because of China's enormous trade power, which is very important to the Middle Eastern countries who might otherwise object and who have obviously objected very loudly to the and properly to the mistreatment of Muslims in other places like the Rohingya, for instance. But it's difficult to object to China when China has so much power over your, you know, your economic wealth. And we saw, of course, last year, sorry to interrupt you, when Mrs. May went to China and notably didn't raise human rights issues, the Chinese press were delighted. They issued warnings before she went that we would all, you know, we would all live to regret it, essentially, were she to raise these kind of ridiculous ideas. And then when she didn't, they praised her for resisting the kind of unreasonable calls of those who wished to criticise China. The liberal press says a lot, human rights organisations say a lot, but governments don't. And they don't. They haven't said a lot, even at the UN. I mean, China's a permanent member of the Security Council, so the UN probably can't do a lot. But these things should be raised.
And does the raising by humanitarian organisations help the conversation?
I would hope so. I mean, talking about it's got to be better than not talking about it. You know, if we all stay silent, then there's no one left to speak for anybody. So I think you just have to hope that the more you talk about it, the more they're sort of drops of water gathering together that eventually might make some difference and might make somebody somewhere think actually people are watching and people do care what we do here.
As you say, lots of organisations in the media have written about the plight of the Uyghur Muslims. Is there something in particular about writing for it for Private Eye that you think should be different or that you try to make different?
Yes, I think it's because Private Eye has such an interest in hypocrisy, I think, generally, and in exposing hypocrisy. I think I always try to find a story to write about where somehow, you know, ideally us, but somebody, us or somebody close to us, is in some way caught up in some sort of denial of what's going on, some sort of determination that we can trade with these people no matter what. So I think I'm looking for that angle of hypocrisy. So if countries that are claiming to be a wonderful focus for attention to human rights, which are not, or countries that clearly haven't and aren't even claiming to have a wonderful human rights record, but that we're clearly wooing and are not wanting to acknowledge what's going on. So it's those things, I think, are the peg that I try and sort of hang things on for Private Eye.
You write about a lot of different parts of the world where human rights abuses occur. Do you notice common themes emerging between them? Because you've written a lot about Sri Lanka, for example, or you've written about immigration into Australia and how and the problems that have happened there.
Yeah, I suppose my most common theme has been torture. And I came into this because I had been seeing patients who'd been tortured, asylum seekers who'd been tortured. So I think that's what led me into wanting to write about human rights. And there are certainly common themes to that. I think that people who torture require, you know, for that to happen, you need an atmosphere of impunity, you need a state that doesn't care, you need an attitude to human rights that isn't really there. You certainly see those common themes in all of the places that I write about.
Some people listening to this might say, well, look, Britain can't help all of these places. There's no point in kicking up a fuss about it. I'm just curious about what you would say to that.
Oh, I would say that would be giving up. And I think it is, again, it's the drop in the ocean thing. The more we talk about these things, the more they're out in the open. And the more chance there is one day somewhere that somebody about to do something terrible will think this might come back at me one day. And as the world opens up, you know, our presence becomes less private individually. There really is that chance that if you do something terrible, your photograph will appear on a website somewhere else in the world, and that will matter. So I think every bit of information, every bit of anything written or spoken that's properly referenced, that's, you know, that's as true as we can make it, that makes people understand a little bit more about things that are going on that shouldn't be, it exposes it. It makes people care. Somebody, you know, makes people make a difference.
Dr. Grimm there. Now, last week, the news came that an important political figure had passed away. Someone who was incredibly powerful behind the scenes in government. Someone accused of manipulating the honours system for their own ends. Someone even accused of having an affair with the then Prime Minister, Harold Wilson. And, for that matter, keeping private eyes lawyers extremely busy across the years. And who better to tell us about this person's tortured history with the eye than the magazine's official historian, Adam McQueen, and, of course, one of the pillars of the Street of Shame, Francis Ween. Here is Francis explaining exactly who this mysterious figure was.
She was Marcia Williams, Harold Wilson's political secretary in the 1960s and 70s when he was Prime Minister. And she was in private eye from the 1960s onwards. I mean, she's almost as old as the magazine itself. I was looking in the index today and I found, for example, the huge number of references to her, but it says intense dislike of BBC, and that was in 1966. So nothing much changed because she disliked the BBC so intensely. She then sued it, or threatened to sue it rather, years later when I wrote a play she took against on the BBC. But anyway, there's a whole section in her index entry here where it says honours, because she was closely associated with honours, and there's an amazing list of pieces we ran about her various dishings out of honours to her friends and financial benefactors, which is what most famously in Wilson's resignation honours list when he stood down in 1976. It was her last chance to dish out a few more baubles, and so John Vasier, the man who'd organised her children's private education, was given a peerage, and another chap called Eric Miller, who had bought her a house, was given a knighthood, and so it went on. This is the list which was known as the Lavender List, because Joe Haynes, who also worked at Number 10, saw it in her handwriting on some what he called lavender-coloured paper. She insisted it was lilac, but same thing. And she also denied she had anything to do with the list.
And Adam, you wrote about this in the official history of Private Eye.
I did, yeah. I mean, it's a weird question when you say who was Marcia Faulkner, because I don't think there's ever been an equivalent figure. I was trying to say, she wielded an enormous amount of power in both of Harold Wilson's governments, didn't she? She was, I mean, you think of Alistair Campbell being, you know, the great sort of unelected deputy prime minister under Tony Blair. Do you think she was sort of equivalent sort of?
I think that's the nearest equivalent, yes. I mean, he was supposedly only a, you know, glorified press officer, but he did, in the end, turn into a sort of Marcia, except no one ever suggested that he was sleeping with Blair. Whereas with Marcia and Harold Wilson, there were mutterings over the years. I remember in the 1964 election campaign, Quintin Hogg, the Tory MP, made some remark when someone, a heckler at a meeting, said, "What about Profumo then?" He said, "Well, I will not take lectures on Profumo until you start looking at adulterers on the other benches, the Labour benches." And this was taken to refer to Wilson and Marcia Williams, and she had a near breakdown over it and said, Harold, you've got to sue Quintin Hogg." And amazingly, only 3 years later, 1967, when The Move, the pop group, brought out that single Flowers in the Rain and famously sent a postcard, which had a picture of Harold Wilson in the nude in bed with Marcia, and Wilson sued, and it means that all royalties in perpetuity of that single go to Harold Wilson's chosen charities. The QC he got to do that case against The Move was none other than Quintin Hogg, the man who 3 years earlier had also suggested that Wilson and Marcia were an item, but there we are.
Were they an item?
Is it possible to say? Well, all you can say with reasonable certainty is that Joe Haynes, who was the other right-hand man, I mean, he went through everything with them, and who fell out with her rather spectacularly, he said that there was a day when Wilson said to Joe Haynes, "Oh, God, I've had such trouble at home because Marcia got in a temper because I went home to my wife's birthday rather than going out with Marcia." And so Marcia confronted Mary and said, "I stepped with your husband 6 times in 1956. It wasn't satisfactory." So Marcia had said this to Mary. Mary then told Harold. Harold then told Joe Haynes. He said, "Oh, God, you'll never guess what Marcia's done now." So all we do know is that Harold Wilson said that this had been said by Marcia. It doesn't necessarily mean that they did sleep together, because Harold himself, well, he was a bit odd because he said, "Oh, she's exploded her nuclear bomb now. She can't harm me anymore." And yet in the next breath would say, "Of course I never slept with her." So
it's the most fantastic phrase, isn't it? And it was unsatisfactory. What was she expecting his wife to say at that point? "Oh, I'm terribly sorry. Do you want another go?"
I think she gave it a fair trial 6 times. You know, after the first couple of times, not. Well, perhaps if we stick at it, we'll get the hang of it, but apparently not. Six times was enough.
One person that we do know she was having a relationship with, and we printed as much in Private Eye at the time, which caused great fury in Number 10, was Walter Terry, who was... He was political editor on various different newspapers,
he was political editor on the Mail at the time when he was impregnating the Prime Minister's secretary. Which was quite good going. So political editor of the Daily Mail, not a Labour-supporting paper exactly, famously. And he was popping in and out of Downing Street. And the Mail was very grateful. He was getting all these scoops from Walter Terry when he wasn't sleeping with the Prime Minister.
One of the stories that the Eye ran in the 70s was that red boxes were actually delivered round to Marcia Faulkner's house and sort of taken in at the door from the government car by Walter Terry, I think. Which is fairly extraordinary. A political editor of the Daily Mail accepting red boxes. I mean, this is a big... amazingly, we can actually find another slightly more modern equivalent of this, because it's Angie Hunter, who was yes. Tony Blair's right-hand woman, got into a relationship with Adam Bolton, who was political editor of Sky News at that point. And that was considered to be such a major thing in terms of conflicts of interest. She actually stepped down from Downing Street, didn't she, as a result of that relationship. So for this to be sort of covered up, I mean, it was very much covered up by the whole rest of the press. Everyone knew in Fleet Street.
Well, we revealed it in 1974, and the children were born in 68 and 69, I think, her sons, by the Daily Mail's political editor. So it was 5 years later that Private Eye, at long last, published this fact.
And these, of course, were the children that were then put through private school,
yes.
At the expense of various donors to Harold Wilson's office, which, again, is sort of not the sort of thing that a socialist government should really be about, is it?
So was there a lawsuit resulting from all this?
I don't think she ever sued the Eye, did she?
She never sued the Eye, no, but there was in Wilson's second administration, so 74 to 76, there was this incredible paranoia and bunker mentality, wasn't there? Mm. And Richard Ingrams, the editor of Private Eye at that point, said that he learned from various sources that at one point Marcia was so annoyed with something that the Eye had written about him that she had to be physically restrained from actually coming straight round to Greek Street, where the Eye offices were at that point, and punching him in the face. So maybe she was going for slightly more direct routes than just suing us.
And was she still on the scene at that point, so after the Eye had made these revelations?
Oh, yeah. She was still his political secretary right up until he resigned in 1976, even after we'd revealed that she was having children with the Daily Mail's political editor, and after all the other scandals she was involved in to a greater or lesser extent. There was a now-forgotten huge scandal at the time called the Slag Heap Affair, which we and lots of other newspapers wrote about at enormous lengths. It was to do with her brother, I think, a man called Tony Field, and a land reclamation scheme up north. And it all hinged on whether it was development or reclamation, because Wilson was very anti-property developers, but he said, this is different, it's environmentally friendly. They were just, this slag heap was being converted into residential land, so it's all right for Marcia to have a financial interest in it, and very murky and strange.
But it was at the height of that, wasn't it, that Wilson showed his support for her by making her a member of the House of Lords?
Yes.
She became, Lady Slagheap, as the Eye dubbed her at the time. Fairly extraordinary kind of showing your support for your secretary when she's dragging you into an extraordinary scandal.
Yes, that was directly because of the Slagheap affair that she got her peerage. Asked for it, I think, as well, and got it, which is, again, a bit like the knighthood for Jimmy Goldsmith in the resignation honours list.
Yes, the knighthood for Jimmy Goldsmith, which I think originally she wanted him to have a peerage, didn't she?
She did,
I think
yes.
It was downgraded because he was thought to be terribly unsuitable. Certainly, I mean, Goldsmith was an extraordinary figure for a Labour leader to be naming in his resignation honours, because, I mean, there are none more capitalist than Jimmy Goldsmith, absolutely rapacious billionaire financier taking over companies all over the world and ruthlessly cutting them back at that point, but also ruthlessly going after Private Eye, famously, in 1976 over a story about Lord Lucan. And it was always a bit of a mystery why he was so fiercely opposed to Private Eye over what was quite a minor reference to him in that story. 63 different writs he fired off against Private Eye. Not only Private Eye, all its distributors, even down to sort of individual news agents to try and get the thing taken off the shelves. And it was strongly believed, there's quite a lot of evidence that actually he was doing that on behalf of the Downing Street bunker, on behalf of Faulkner and of Wilson himself, because they were so cross with all of the stuff that was coming out at that point. And Richard Ingrams, the editor, was told that the was a very weird citation on Goldsmith's knighthood, which was that it was for services for ecology. And it was actually his brother. It was Teddy Goldsmith, wasn't it?
Yeah,
he was editor of The Ecologist and was sort of one of the big early Greens. And a lot of people thought they just sort of got muddled in some way. But supposedly this was a private joke. It was about his services on ridding the country of the pollution of Private Eye rather than anything else, which, of course, he failed at, thankfully. And there was this idea within the bunker at number 10 that this was just persecution and a kind of personal animus about these things. But, I mean, these are major stories. Not only the thing about Walter Terry, but also there was a guy called Michael Halls, a civil servant, whose widow, the eye discovered, was pursuing the Treasury for compensation, claiming that he'd been driven to his fatal heart attack by the stress and strain of working in Whitehall and the demands that were made on him specifically by Marcia Williams. And that was sort of a big ongoing case. So, you know, there were some extraordinary stories coming out of Number 10 at the time, which the Eye at the time seemed to be the only people who were interested in covering.
And Francis, you wrote about all this not so long ago in dramatic form.
I did. Well, actually, it was a little while ago now. It's about 12 years ago, 13 years ago. It was on the anniversary, I think, the 30th anniversary of his resignation. The BBC asked me to do a play to be called The Lavender List about Wilson's last couple of years in Number 10. Dramatising in particular the revelations that had recently come out from people who worked there, like Joe Haynes and Bernard Donoghue. They'd just published diaries and memoirs full of extraordinary stories and details. And so I did this, and it was legal to the hilt. I mean, the lawyers went through every dot and comma, as you would imagine, since, amazingly, most of the people involved were still alive, apart from Wilson himself. Almost everyone was, you know, Mary Wilson, Marcia Williams, Faulkender, as she became Lady Forkbender, and all the others. So it was heavily lawyered, and we had Joe Haynes, Bernard Donoghue, all these other first-hand witnesses ready to testify if anyone sued, because Marcia refused to cooperate. She wouldn't talk to us about it. But we cast Gina McKee to play Marcia Williams, which we thought was rather flattering. And the producer actually took round to Marcia photographs of Gina McKee, said, "I just thought you might like to see who's playing you in this thing with which you're not cooperating. You know, you might be quite pleased to see it's this actress." But even that didn't save us. The moment it went out, Carter Ruck, guess who, sent a letter on her behalf saying, "Marcia Williams, Lady Forkbender, is not very happy about this thing," suggesting that she had a hand in Wilson's resignation honours list and implying that she slept with him. Then the BBC cancelled the repeat. I mean, within days, they were due to be repeating it on BBC Four, let alone the BBC Two showing that was meant to go on later in the year, and capitulated. And it was because at the time, I mean, it was only a couple of years after the Hutton inquiry, and so the BBC was on the ropes. Do you remember the Director General, Greg Dyke, and the Chairman, Gavin Davis, both had to resign, and the BBC was in a blue funk at the time. And on top of that, particularly about libel, they'd just had a colossal libel settlement with a diamond company called Oryx. There'd been a blunder in the television news. And when Oryx sued, initially the BBC was sort of, "No, we stand by our story, we're going to fight this all the way." And then they had to capitulate, and it cost them £1 million. And after that, the order went out saying, "Oh, we don't defend libel actions anymore. It's too expensive. So if any libel threats or things that look like libel threats come in, just settle at once. Never think of defying them." So even though we had all these witnesses ready to go, the BBC legal department all raring to go, the order came down from on high, I think from the Deputy Director General and the Director of Television. No, we don't fight libel suits anymore. So pay her lots of money and whatever it takes. So she got an apology, £75,000 plus Carter Rock's costs, which are never small, and an undertaking that it would never be shown again.
Until now?
Well, I don't know. I think their undertaking was that they will never ever show it, you know, in perpetuity. It's a bit like that MOVE single, Flowers in the Rain. Even though Wilson's dead, all the royalties still go to the Harold Wilson Charitable Trust. But if the BBC don't summon up some courage and do it now, I might have to do it myself in a very public place.
Sell it to Netflix for millions and millions of pounds. This is the way forward.
That's probably the way forward, actually. Then they'd be really ashamed, wouldn't they? They might belatedly put it on iPlayer.
That would be nice.
12 years too late. Perhaps they could have a little sequel as well about the whole business of the BBC capitulating to Lady Forkbender, make a little drama in its own right.
That was Francis Wheen, and before him, Adam McQueen. That's it for this episode of Page 94. We will be back again in a fortnight with another one. Until then, thank you for listening, and if you've enjoyed it, there is a copy of Private Eye on the newsstands with your name on it. Although, hopefully not your name in it. Thanks very much. Goodbye.